So, what's up, Betamaxers? We are back, and, well, over COVID, finally. I hope it hadn't affected my leathery, smooth voice too much. This week, we're talking about one of my all-time favorite films, favorite animated films, released July 2nd, 1982, The Secret of Nim. Tagline is, right before your eyes and beyond your wildest dreams. The film's based on the book Mrs. Frisbee and the Rats of Nim, released in 1972, written by Robert C. O'Brien and illustrated by Zena Bernstein. The book won the Newbery Award for Children's Literature. I actually read the book way back, maybe sixth grade, I believe, and did a book report on it. Honestly, though, I don't really remember a whole lot from the book. Especially differences between the movie. I've seen the movie more times than I can count. But yeah, I think the biggest difference I can remember is I don't think the book had some of the mystical elements that the film had. So what's the movie about? Well, as always, we start with our 2-second synopsis. Furry things happen. So a much longer synopsis. A widowed field mouse named of Mrs. Brisby must figure out a way to move her family and her home from the farmer's field that they live in before it gets plowed for spring planting. Complicating this move is the fact that her youngest child is too sick to leave the house. So with the help of some escaped lab rats, who also live on the farm, they come up with a plan to move the entire house to safety before the home is destroyed by the tractor. So it's a pretty simple plot. I mean, it is a kid's movie, but it does take some interesting twists and turns along the way. Now, Nim, even though it's all capitalized in the title, is actually the National Institute for Mental Health, and it is an actual facility. And the initial idea for the book and for the hyper-intelligent rats that are in it came from research conducted by John B. Calhoun on mouse and rat populations at the National Institute for Mental Health from the late 40s up through the 60s. This is the first film produced by the Don Bluth company. Now, Don Bluth was an animator for Disney for years. He got his start as an animator's assistant all the way back in 1959 on Sleeping Beauty. Some of the other films that he was involved with over the years include The Sword in the Stone, Robin Hood, which to this day remains probably my favorite Disney animated film, The Rescuers, Pete's Dragon, Fox and the Hound. For other studios or for himself, he's also responsible for The Brave Little Toaster, All Dogs Go to Heaven, Rockadoodle, An American Tale, The Land Before Time, Anastasia, Titan, A.E. He also did work back in the 60s on the television show Groovy Ghoulies. The Don Bluth Animation Studio was also responsible for all of the graphics for the video games Dragon's Lair and Space Ace as well. Lord, those are two titles I hadn't thought about in years. You know, it is kind of hard nowadays. You look at, you know, how realistic video games are, or, you know, you look at the stuff like Borderlands that's got more of a cel-shaded look to it. And it's just really, it's hard to explain to people just how jaw-dropping and mind-blowing Dragon's Lair and Space Ace was when they come out. I mean, you have to understand, this is the early 80s. Your phone, you know, the pixel games on your phone are more advanced and have better graphics than what you would see in arcades back in the early to mid-80s. You know, very pixelated, blocky graphics. And then all of a sudden here comes this game, Dragon's Lair, and it's an animated film in an arcade cabinet. And it just sort of blew everyone away. And it's, you know, nowadays the technology behind it is probably kind of primitive, because it was basically if I remember right, it was basically a laser disc, and then you're pressing the buttons and moving the joystick would make it jump chapters, and it was a twitch and memory game. You had to figure out the pattern to get through each of the stages, but it was just, like, it was mind-blowing for you know, me in the early 80s, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old to just walk in and see this thing and to play it. And I just could not imagine, you know, anything like that back then. Even today, you know, when we can recreate something like that and, you know, make it 3D and open world, et cetera, et cetera. It's just hard to wrap around how big Dragon Age and Space Ace was when they come out. It was like seeing 20 years into the future. Now, when the book originally came out in the early 70s, it was actually, according to some of the sources I looked up while researching this, it was actually pitched to Disney as a possible animated film, and they weren't interested in it. And a few years later, it was brought to Bluth's attention by one of the other animators at Disney, and they pitched it to Disney again, and Disney rejected it again on the grounds that, one, they already had mouse characters, and two, they had recently done a film that featured mice as the central characters, the Rescuers, which come out in 1976, I believe. Bluth and several other animators and people at Disney, though, saw the potential of the book, thought it would make a great film, a great story. And so on September 13th, 1979, Bluth and several other animators and people left Disney and formed Don Bluth Productions and began trying to acquire the funds and the rights to the book so that they could turn it into their first feature film. Now, here's the thing you have to understand with, just sort of put it into historical perspective. Disney was king of the feature-length animated film and had been for decades, going all the way back to Snow White in the 30s. You know, that's not to say there hadn't been studios who had put out feature-length animated films, but nobody had really had the success or produced a film that could match Disney at the box office. So the idea that Bluth and these other animators were going to put out a movie to, you know, challenge Disney, you know, put a Disney quality movie into theaters at the time, it's a little crazy. But here's the other thing. Disney was pretty much still dominating because they were the only ones consistently putting out these kind of films. The quality of Disney animated films in the late 70s and through the 80s, you know, where I talked about a little bit more in depth in the Bedknobs and Broomsticks episode. You know, we're kind of in the dark age of Disney film. They'd been doing more live action films. They had been doing animated films, but there's not a lot of Disney animated films in this era that are really remembered well today or considered classics. You know, we're talking the Black Cauldron era. We're talking The Fox and the Hound. You know, like those kind of films. Like, Disney was still number one, but at this point it was really more because they were almost a monopoly than because they were actually producing, to just put it bluntly, Disney quality films, basically. But Bluth and the rest of the crew, you know, found a studio willing to work with them, willing to budget the film. The original budget, I believe, I'm not sure if my notes are correct. You got to remember, I was recovering from COVID while I was doing some of these notes. Was around $7 million. But then the budget got cut, and it fell down to $5.7 million. On top of that, they were given 30 months to make the film. And both of these are just absolute insanity. You know, this is a hand-animated film. Every frame, every cell is painted, you know, photographed. The backgrounds are painted. There's no computer graphics to any of this. And so Don Bluth Productions was aiming to make a film that could rival anything Disney put out for a much smaller budget and for a much shorter time frame than what Disney was making their movies for. You know, most Disney movies, even the animated ones this time, would have budgets, you know, $10 million plus easily, and at least 4 years from concept to being released in the theaters. So, you know, Bluth and company were basically setting out to do the impossible. And you know, on top of the deadlines and the restrictions the studio placed on them, just starting out, they ran into several other problems along the way and overcome them beautifully. I mean, the finished film, I would put it up against any Disney movie, hand-drawn, animated, they have ever done. It is just an absolutely beautiful film. Bluth, I watched the film twice, watched it once, and then watched it once again with the commentary track. And he talks about how much he loved the golden age of animation, the 30s and the 40s. You know, how beautiful everything looked then, how well animated it was. And he brought all that to this film. Hearing him talk about it and the techniques they used, they actually, in order to pull off some of the shots in the film, had to have two camera rigs specially made for this film in order to pull off some of the shots he had storyboarded and they were trying to animate. And the movie itself, like I said, he did not skimp on it. He wanted to make something beautiful. They used rotoscoping and live model for some of the sequences. And if you're not familiar with rotoscoping, it's basically motion capture for hand-drawn animation. What they would do, and it's been done ever since animation has been a thing, you would film somebody in costume or going through the movements, especially if they were complicated movements such as dance sequences or fights. And then you would project that, and the animators would come in and frame by frame draw over the live action and match it exactly. Now, done well, it's seamless. You know, I'm trying to think. Alice in Wonderland by Disney features a lot of reference and some rotoscoping. Sleeping Beauty, the dance sequence where she dances with the animals and, you know, filling out the clothing, that was rotoscoped. They used references of someone dancing in order to get that across. It can be a good tool, but there have been films, especially some of the Ralph Bakshi films, and we hadn't done a film by him yet, where he's done rotoscoping, and like I said, done well, like in this movie or in the Disney films, it just blends in seamlessly. Done the way it's done in some of the Bakshi films, it sort of knocks me out of the movie. You can tell the rotoscoping in something like The Hobbit or in the film Fire and Ice, where, you know, like I said, done poorly, it's such a disconnect between the rotoscoped characters and the other animated elements. You know, it's like an uncanny valley. That's the word I'm looking for. It's kind of like the uncanny valley. In the back of your head, you know, an animated character's really not supposed to move just like a real person, just like you and I do. So it can be a little disconcerting to see it done. A lot of the rotoscoping, though, for Secret of Nim, however, turned out to be just props or sets. He talks about there's a scene at the beginning where we see Nicodemus, who's one of the characters. We'll get to the characters here in a second. Opening up a chest and putting an amulet in it, just a little like jewelry chest. And he says, "I actually still have that chest." And, you know, so for them, it wasn't so much movement. They were going for realism in the backgrounds and the setting and the props. And so, like, they built a chest and they filmed somebody opening it so that they could get all the angles right on this object as it opened up. There's a sequence where Mrs. Brisby and Mr. Age and Justin, one of the rats, is going down under the rose bush to see the rest of the rats and get them to help move Mrs. Brisby's house. And he explained that they took photos and films. They got out on an elevator that's an old lantern, an old like porch lantern. And he talks about that they bought a porch lantern and painted it and then put black, you know, painted all the edges really dark black, and then filmed it being lowered down and the way it swayed and rotoscoped that so that, you know, it would actually look like a lantern, and they would get all the angles right for the shots that they needed it done in. And that's just one of the things that they did to get this film right. He talks about on the commentary track about lighting and about depth of field. He actually pointed out, and I started watching for it after he pointed out in the commentary track, there are elements of the background of the film, which is just the background that they're animating the characters on, but they deliberately made some elements of the background blurry or out of focus in order to mimic the depth of field you would get from using a camera for a live action film. There are elements in the background they did all throughout the film to do that, to mimic it, to sort of trick you into buying into this world a little more. Shiny objects cast reflections. There's translucency to some of the characters. And all this just became hallmarks of Don Bluth. And he talks about the tricks they did in order to do that, backlit some of the characters in order to get certain effects, like the glowing eyes of the Great Owl and Nicodemus, which even today, I mean, I'm almost 50 years old, and the way their eyes glow on those two characters still, I find just really creepy. And it's just a simple backlit trick to get them to do that, but it just works so well and sort of adds to the mystical nature of the characters, the otherworldliness of both of the characters. But to me, talking about the artistry of the film, I just love Don Bluth's style anyway. There's just a look to his films that I've always really enjoyed. Even after, I fell in love with this film. It was the first one I remember. Well, it's the first one he did. But I've always loved the look of his films. But he talks about they did multiple color palettes for each of the characters. Now, there's a thing that you'll see every once in a while. People talk there's a goof in the film that some of the characters and some of the clothing they wear changes color. That's not a goof. Don Bluth and the animators put together, based on the lighting of the background, based on the what time of day it was, et cetera, et cetera. They took all that into effect, and they came up with a different color palette for each of the characters in each of the lighting setups that they would be in. So, yeah, there are some scenes where, we'll talk about Mrs. Brisby and the little cloak she wears, it's bright red. Some scenes it's dull. Some scenes it looks a little more pinkish, a little more purplish, and that's not a goof. That is the color of her cloak, following color theory, changing based on the lighting situation that she is in. In fact, according to Don Bluth, Mrs. Brisby alone has 46 different color palettes, 46 different ways for her to be painted, depending on whether it's day, night, she's inside, she's outside, she's under natural light, under artificial light, under light cast by flame, etc. 46 different ways for one character in this film. Now, if you're sitting there wondering the book is Mrs. Frisbee and the character is Mrs. Brisby, well, it boils down to a toy company. Of course, everybody's heard of the Frisbee Flying Disc. Well, Don Bluth and his studio contacted the makers of Frisbee and explained that they were making a movie, and that was the character's name, and they wanted to get a licensing to use the name and get a credit, give them a credit. And were turned down. And so Mrs. Frisbee became Mrs. Brisby. The problem was, by the time they got word back, most of the dialogue had been recorded. And this being 1982, there was no digital editing. And so they literally had to go back to every one of the vocal tracks and find instances where each of the voice actors made the buh sound, and then go in and splice that over the F sound, changing Frisbee to Brisby, because they didn't have the time or money to get the voice actors back into the studio to just re-record the lines with Mrs. Brisby's name in it. Now, Mrs. Brisby herself is voiced by Elizabeth Hartman. Some of her bigger films include A Patch of Blue from 1965, The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, The Beguiled, which, interesting little bit of trivia, is the first film that Clint Eastwood's character dies in. In fact, there was a sticking point between the makers of the film and the studio. They didn't want Clint Eastwood to die in the film, even though the character dies in the book it's based on. I recently read the book it's based on. It's all right. It's not one of my favorites. I don't regret reading it, but it, it's not one I'd reread again. But I do still want to see the movie, both the Clint Eastwood and the remake they did a few years ago with Colin Farrell and was that Nicole Kidman, I think? She was also the love interest in the original Walking Tall film all the way back in 1971. I loved those movies when I was a kid. I remember seeing them on TV. I wonder if they're streaming anywhere. I kind of want to go back and watch them again. I can't even remember the name of the guy who was in them, but I loved the films. Back to this film, this would turn out to be Elizabeth Hartman's last film. She retired from acting shortly after recording her lines as Mrs. Brisby, and sadly would pass away in 1987 after a decades-long struggle with depression and other mental illnesses. Interestingly, Mrs. Brisby is never given a first name in the film. Everyone just refers to her as Mrs. Brisby. I did see online in several places that some fans of the film have actually put up a headcanon that Mrs. Brisby's first name is really Elizabeth in honor of Hartman, who voiced the character. And like I saw it on the internet, I don't know if it's true. It's become my headcanon, though. I could see Mrs. Brisby's first name being Elizabeth, so from now on it is. Dom DeLuise plays the crow Jeremy, who Mrs. Brisby rescues from the farm cat dragon and becomes a friend to her and her family. Dom DeLuise, oh my God, comedy legend. Loved him as a kid. Especially loved seeing him paired with Burt Reynolds, another favorite actor of mine from the 70s and 80s. You can catch Dom DeLuise in The 12 Chairs. He has a small role as a director in The Blazing Saddles. He teamed up with Burt Reynolds in films like The End, the Cannonball Run films, which, again, hilarious, Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. He would also do voices not only for this Don Bluth film, but also An American Tale and All Dogs Go to Heaven. I can't think of a film I've seen with Dom DeLuise that I didn't think he was hilarious and brilliant in. Mrs. Brisby's neighbor is Auntie Shrew, who's played by Hermione Baddeley. She's appeared in such films as Mary Poppins, The Aristocats, the Batman TV show, and the film Unsinkable Molly Brown. She also appeared in the film Chomps, which was about a robot dog. And the only reason I bring that up is when I saw that, there's another podcast called Vintage Video, and that's one of the films that they've discussed is Chomps. And just seeing it, because they talked about it so much and played it so much during the episode, I hear the theme song from that film in my head. I've never seen the film, but just hearing them talk about it and listen to that episode as many times as they brought it up, I can hear it in my head now as I'm recording this. And I don't know if any of them listen to my podcast, but I will make you pay for having this earworm stuck in my head for as long as it's been. Mr. Ages is another mouse that Mrs. Brisby goes to get medicine for her sick child. He's voiced by Arthur Mallett, who was in Mary Poppins, Hook, Halloween, the Robin Williams movie Toys. He had some appearances on the Andy Griffith Show. He is in Bedknobs and Broomsticks. He has also had a small appearance in the Mel Brooks film Young Frankenstein. The Great Owl is acting legend John Carradine, who got his start in the film Bright Lights, Telegraph, and Newspaper in 1930, and worked all the way up until his death in 1989, a 59-year career. And was every movie he ever did a great classic? No. He had, I was going to call it Nicolas Cage syndrome. It did not seem like he would turn down a role. He's got a resume longer than I am tall. And Well, there's some great classics on there. Small roles and things like The Invisible Man, The Bride of Frankenstein, the John Ford film Stagecoach, Ten Commandments, Around the World in 80 Days. He also has a resume full of stuff like Hillbillies in a Haunted House, the Astro Zombies, Honey Britches, Satan's Cheerleaders, Vampire Hookers, Ice Pirates, and Peggy Sue Got Married. John Carradine also has one of the greatest voices I think I've ever heard in my life. It's no matter what role he was in, he had this deep, powerful voice that made you pay attention to everything he said, made everything he said just seem important, no matter how silly the dialogue actually turned out to be. Bluth actually likes telling us a story about Carradine, and that Carradine came in and to record his lines, and they had to get him focused. Apparently, he was on some kind of medicine. He was, I think, recovering from something, and so he says when he first came in, we had to sit and talk to him and get him to tell stories. In order to focus him enough in order to record the lines. And then once he started recording the lines as the Great Owl, he did one take and was done. Apparently Bluth says he would read the line, declare it the greatest reading he could possibly give that line, and then move on to the next one. Nicodemus, the leader of the rats of Nim, is voiced by Derek Jacobi, who appeared in the 1965 production of Othello. And also done films such as Day of the Jackal, Dead Again, the most recent Tomb Raider film, Gladiator, Gosford Park, Nanny McPhee, and also appearances in the TV shows Doctor Who and Good Omens. Now, the interesting thing is that, like I said, the Great Owl and Nicodemus both have these really disturbing, glowing eyes. And I always, like I said, as a kid, it freaked me out. Even rewatching the film, it's a little creepy. Bluth actually says in the commentary tracks, and I never thought about it, he sees the Great Owl and Nicodemus as avatars of the same entity. And that's why their eyes are identical. He said that when they was putting the film together and they was doing the concept art, etc., that in his mind, and even today, he just sees the Great Owl and Nicodemus as the same supernatural entity. The solution to Mrs. Brisby's problem is just different avatars of it, different aspects of it. And I can see that. Another couple of little quick notes about the cast, and then I want to talk about a criticism I've seen about the film that I don't agree with. This would be the film debut of Shannon Doherty, who you may know from Charmed or 90210, and Will Wheaton, who you may know from Star Trek The Next Generation or various... YouTube videos, etc. They did the voices of Mrs. Brisby's children. Aldo Ray voices one of the rats, and the reason I'm bringing that up is that Aldo Ray also was in Psychic Killer, which was the very first movie we did on the podcast. Now, like I said, before we get into it and get into the final segment of this, I want to talk a little bit about the Secret of Nim and the impact it had. In order to finish the film, Bluth and several other people attached to the film actually put another mortgage on their homes to raise $700,000 more to finish the film. The studio, at the last minute, cut down the number of theaters it was going to be released into, so the film didn't make as much money as they were hoping to. I think the final box office total was, depending on, I've seen different sources, between $10 to $15 million. The film really took off when it hit home video rentals and, started being broadcast on, TV, the movie channels, HBO, etc. I remember I rented it from, I didn't see it in theaters. I saw it on home video. I rented it. But then again, one of the other things you have to remember is summer of 1982. Like I said, the film came out July 2nd. E.T., which made over $300 million in 1982, had just hit theaters a couple of weeks before Secret of Nim. Star Trek II, Wrath of Khan, had just hit theaters a few weeks, just shortly before Secret of Nim come out. Poltergeist come out that summer. Blade Runner come out that summer. Blade Runner actually come out, I think, the week before. The Thing. What else? It's just, around the time this poor movie was thrown out into theaters, there were so many films out. And, it wasn't like it is today where you have multiplexes and you know, the chances and chances to see these films. You know, back in 1982, we had 4 movie theaters in my town, and each one showed 1 movie. And they may be that, you know, like E.T. stayed around for a while. Some of them would stick around for a while. But, you know, a lot of them, you might get a week, you might get 2 weeks, and that's it. So Poor Secret of Nim didn't really stand much of a chance when it was released in theaters. But it had a huge impact beyond its box office. Like I said, they took on Disney, and Disney blinked. You know, Don Bluth and company put out a movie that is as good, not as good, it is better than the Disney films produced in this era. It's a beautiful film. It is a, I love the soundtrack. It's a great vocal, you know, great voice cast. It is a really good film. And, you know, it sort of breaks my heart that it's not a bigger film. You know, it's not one that gets brought up a whole lot and talked about. Because it did do that. You know, it did show Disney and show, you know, other studios that, no, we can compete with you. You know, it come out, and just a couple of years, you know, a few short years down the road, basically the life cycle of what it would take Disney to put a film out, we hit Disney's second golden age. You know, just a few years after this, we start seeing, you know, we get The Little Mermaid, which is, you know, the start of Disney's second golden age of animation. And Bluth doesn't let up. You know, I would argue Secret of Nim is my favorite film by him. I would even say it's the best film he's done, in my opinion, out of all the ones I've seen. But he didn't let up. You know, he went on to do things like An American Tale, All Dogs Go to Heaven, you know, and put these films out, and they're remembered, you know, by a lot of people just as fondly as some of the Disney films from this era. You know, Bluth, like I said, he took them on and he forced them to get better because he decided he was going to be that good. And even beyond that, some of the people that worked on this film went on to have huge impact on the animated world. Bruce Timm was an assistant animator on this film. It was his first film, if I'm remembering right. And, you know, just a few short years down the road, he would go on to create Batman the Animated Series, which would bring us, you know, new interpretations of the characters, would actually, you know, be responsible for making Mr. Freeze the character that he is now. That interpretation of it is still, in my opinion, one of the best interpretations of the Batman character. You know, and Bruce Timm would create Harley Quinn, which is still a character that is impacting pop culture, both live action and an animated series on HBO Max. So, like I said, the film, you know, may have been a pebble thrown in a pond, but the ripples of it are still going through pop culture and animation to this day. You know, so I do think the film deserves a little more respect than we've been given it since it came out 40 years ago. I'm running a little long, but I can't walk away from the episode without addressing one final criticism I keep seeing about this film and why I disagree with it. I keep seeing a criticism talking about that how smart can the rats of Nim be if every animal that we meet in the film can talk and, you know, manipulate tools, etc., be anthropomorphic like, you know, animal characters are in animated films. What makes the rats so special? They lose their specialness because they're just like all the other animal characters. And they're not. It's another level to this film, the fact that Bluth and company don't beat you over the head and just blatantly point out, you know, how the rats are different. It's one of the things you have to pay attention to the story. You have to pay attention to the backgrounds, the personalities of the characters, and I'll just break down what I mean. If you pay attention to the film, there's several different levels of intelligence and self-awareness in each of the animal characters. At the bottom, you've got Dragon, the farm cat, who's just a cat. He never talks. He never does anything outside of what you'd expect a normal cat to do. So, like, he's the baseline. Now, yeah, again, because we're used to anthropomorphic animals in these films, when we encounter Mrs. Brisby and we encounter Jeremy, and they're talking to each other, we just accept it. I mean, this is the norm for films. But already, in these three characters, we're seeing differences. You know, Jeremy, yeah, he talks. Yeah, he, you know, understands some human concepts. But when we meet him, he's gathering up string to build a nest. He doesn't live in a house. He doesn't wear clothing. He does talk, but he's still very animalistic. He doesn't have hands. He still has wings. He's, you know, not worrying about getting married or starting a family. He's building a nest to attract a mate. Still very animalistic behavior. Then you go a step up and we get to Mrs. Brisby and Mrs. Shrew, who do talk, who do wear, you know, scraps for clothing. Mrs. Brisby has her little cloak that she wears when she's out everywhere. And both of them live in homes. Mrs. Brisby, her house is a repurposed cinder block up against a stump. And just about everything in it is repurposed. It's, you know, candle stubs. You know, her cloak is just like a scrap of cloth. There's nothing sewn to it. But we do see a little bit more than that. Mrs. Brisby's husband, Jonathan, is a mouse who went through the same experiments as the rats did. And so did Mr. Ages. And we never meet Jonathan, but if you pay attention to the Brisby home, there's repurposed stuff. Like I said, it's a cinder block. There's candle stubs. You know, she wears a scrap of cloth. But there's also stuff that's built. You know, there's thing. You know, the beds aren't scraps. They're something that's been put together. Mrs. Brisby's kids, who, you know, would have half of Jonathan's DNA, his altered DNA, are working on a different level than her. Her daughter, especially, is dressed in full clothing, you know, a skirt. She has a bow in her hair. You know, she's much more, and it is kind of weird to say this, much more human than even her mother on some levels. And Mr. Ages, same way. He wears a full outfit. He lives in a, you know, a piece of farm equipment that's been broken down. But other than that, a lot of the stuff he uses isn't repurposed. He has envelopes. Who makes envelopes that are mouse-sized? You know, he has lab equipment. He understands diseases. He knows how to make medicine. You know, he's a step beyond Mrs. Brisby, in that Mrs. Brisby and, you know, Mrs. Shrew and most of the animals on the farm repurpose stuff. You know, they'll use scraps, they'll, you know, use stuff they found and just find a new use for it, mimicking what they see the humans do. And then we see Mr. Ages, who is actively inventing stuff or is actively making stuff. You know, he's taking the knowledge he gotten from being a lab experiment and become good with medicine. He knows how to make medicines. He knows how to diagnose medicines. And then we get to the rats. And the rats are working on a completely different level than every other animal we've encountered so far. Yes, they got the repurposed lantern that's an elevator. But once we get below the rose bush, once we get into their area, well, everything's built. You know, there's nothing repurposed. The rats have brick walls. They have, you know, brick flooring. They have television monitors. They have electricity. They're all wearing clothing. They're all wearing armor. They're carrying weapons, battle axes, swords. They have a government. You know, think about that. When watch the movie and watch when Mrs. Brisby and Mr. Ages and Justin is going to talk to the council, and they're having debates about what they're going to do. It's a built section. It is something. You know, they've developed architecture. They have power. They've developed lights. They've developed, like, there's TV monitors. I mean, this is the 80s. The idea of a TV monitor, you know, that a rat, you know, size to a rat, no. They figured out how to make glass. They figured out, you know, sewing and fashion and, you know, forging weapons, metallurgy. They're debating, and this is the part that lets you know that they are, that, you know, how much they have changed compared to their other animal brethren. Like, they have a government, and they're debating whether or not to keep stealing from the farmer. You know, that's the big debate. Do they stay where they're at and keep repurposing and keep stealing electricity from the farmer, or do they set out and build a society free from humans, their own society, and just start from scratch and build something new because it's not right to keep stealing from the farmer? That's just an unbelievable concept for this kind of film. And it's something that lets you know that, no, they're not like all the other animals on the farm. They have this, they've developed morals. The other animals don't think anything about just, okay, taking the trash, taking what they need, and building something with it. And no, the rats are like, no, this isn't right. This isn't something that we should be doing. We need to be creating our own society. The rats want to go beyond living on scraps and mimicking, and they've made the leap to, we're going to build something new, and it's going to be ours. And to me, that's brilliant. You know, the fact that it's all inferred, you know, through design choices and story choices and characters. And, you know, the other thing I'll address, and I'm going to start wrapping this up, is the mysticism part of it. That, you know, Nicodemus seems to have magic powers. That Jonathan, you know, give you an idea that Jonathan was working from a different way than Ages. You know, Ages is scientific. Jonathan created the amulet, the, you know, whatever you call it, magic, psychic powered, whatever amulet that winds up saving his wife and his children and moving their house. You know, so it seems like whatever affected Nicodemus, Jonathan seemed to have a little bit of it too. And you can call it whatever you want, magic, psychic ability, what have you. But, you know, again, it's just another way that the ones who escaped from Nim were different than any of the other animals, despite the fact they could all talk and were on some level very human. So we're going to wrap this up and just get down to the most important question you can ask of a film. Is it entertaining? Yes. Find this movie. Find it somewhere streaming. Go to Dollar Tree. See if they've got it. That's where I found my copy of it on Blu-ray. This is a film that I think everyone should watch. It's not only a good film, it's not only a beautiful film, but it's an important film on a number of levels for a number of reasons. And the way the story is told is just amazing. And it definitely should be a PG movie, though. It's one of those you watch and you think, this was a G movie? G-rated? I'm not the only one. Don Bluth actually brings it up in the commentary that he just knew they was going to get a PG, especially because they drop the word damn in one scene. And he says, you know, we come back and got a G rating. And he says, I think that kind of hurt us as well because, you know, older kids don't want to see G-rated films. So what's next week's film? Let me check my list. Let's stick in the 80s. I don't want to do a more modern one. I don't know if I really want to do an older one either. Let's do the House movies. Mid-80s. I'm not going to try to look at it. I don't care about the year. William Catt, Richard Mall was the first one. The horror comedies, House and House 2. I'm going to do them like Critters. I don't know if it really matters doing one or both of them. But for now, I'm going to say that I'm going to talk about both of them next week. Again, films I watched when I was younger. Hadn't seen them in years. Really looking forward to it. But until then, remember, you can be a lot of things in life. Kind is one of the better ones, especially to yourself. You deserve it. You deserve to be happy. You deserve to be loved. You're important. If you want to hear more from me, you can go check me out on TikTok or, and I need to do more of those. I got to figure out something to do, but you can catch me on TikTok at Celluloid Fever Dreams. Find me on Twitter at C Fever Dreams. Find me on Instagram at Celluloid Fever Dreams. But until next Thursday, I've been your leathery, smooth-voiced host, Wyndham Jennings. This has been Celluloid Fever Dreams, and I'd like to thank you for letting me be a little bit part of your week every week. And until next time, good night.